This week on Writers, Inc.
Once I started thinking, okay, well, we're artisan creators. And it's not just the production, it's end-to-end. It's how you approach a career as an artisan as opposed to somebody who's basically working the way that, that big business does.
J.K. Rowling was nearly homeless when she wrote the first Harry Potter book. Stephen King penned Carrie in a small desk wedged between a washer and dryer. James Patterson worked in advertising and famously crafted the Toys R Us theme song long before becoming an author. Join New York Times bestseller J.D. Barker and a panel of industry powerhouses as they pull back the curtain on some of the world's most prolific authors. Where did they start? What is their process? The biggest names in publishing all have origin stories, all have tips and secrets. What does it take to consistently top the bestseller lists and become a household name? Get your notepad out. School's in session. This is Writers, Inc.
Hi, it's Christine Daigle.
I'm Jenna Brown.
A.P. Reinflush.
And I'm J.D. Barker. Welcome to Writers, Inc. So before we get into stuff, I want to ask you all a question. Do you write in present tense or past tense?
Present.
Do you have a preference?
Both. Present. I do both. It depends on the story. Like if I want someone who's a little more unhinged, I tend to use present.
Wow. Christine's silent. Well,
why would unhinged be present tense? I'm not sure I get that.
I don't know. I think I just it lends better to that voice if you have someone who's maybe a little bit more unreliable or a little bit more different. I think it's the present tense works better.
I just prefer it. I think especially if you're dealing with like action, it just kind of keeps you grounded a little bit. Like, and it could just be a me thing, but like I hate omnipresent, like where you're just like sort of every, like I feel like it's cheating in a way. Like I just really enjoy, I guess, being so I prefer first person present. Like those usually tend to be my favorite books to read, and I find that I tend to write that. So I just really
JP,
like being,
what about
yeah,
you?
I'm third person past.
Okay.
And I are very different. I don't like the omnipresent, though. I like being as close as possible, but there's something about, like, it must be the way that I read stories, and obviously I'm more in the fantasy realm of things. So there's a lot of that, like, storytelling aspect to it, and it almost feels like that lends to that third person past, to me at least.
I'm asking because I just finished up another book with Patterson, and I gave it a final pass before I handed it off, and we wrote it in present tense. But before we started it, I just finished a book that was in past tense. Mm-hmm. You know, so I had to make that switch in my head, and like my brain doesn't want to do that very quickly. Like it's always it takes a little bit. And like when I was going through the read through, like I could see it. You know, like I started in present tense, and then like a couple sentences would sneak in past tense, and then I corrected it. You know, so I had to go back and fix it. And probably about a third of the way through the book, all of a sudden everything was in present tense and it was all good. But then today I started a new book and I have to write it in past tense, third person, because it's part of the 4MK trilogy and that's how the other ones are written. So it feels like I need to continue that. So now I'm trying to get my brain to switch back and I'm running into the opposite problem where like everything coming out of my head is present tense. But in all honesty, like this has shifted over the years. And I think we've talked about this before, but like King in On Writing said that present tense should be reserved for short fiction and past tense for long fiction. And he's even started going in present tense. And when I asked him about it, his reasoning made perfect sense. He said that if you write in present tense and you have to do a flashback scene, you write the flashback in past tense. You know, and it's very seamless to the reader. Your brains just pick up on what's going on. So it makes perfect sense. So like I've been trying to write everything new in present tense. In you know, flashbacks and past and stuff, but with the 4MK thing, I'm kind of stuck.
So I need
to find a quick way to be able to flip that switch.
I will say I do like, and I guess this is maybe my preference in writing present tense, is that you know, when you write in past tense and you have flashbacks, it can be a little bit tricky for the reader, but also like some of the grammar, like what do you like past perfect, and you have to like start doing things that feel very unnatural to me, and I never know if I'm doing it right, and it gets muddled. And so it is easier for me as both a reader and a writer to stay in present tense and then use past tense appropriately for the past.
Yeah, now write a whole book in future tense.
No, thank you.
No.
Oh, God.
It's even worse.
Second person future.
No. There's our challenge.
Absolutely not. No.
Wow. Jenna, you said, what were you about to tell us right before we hit record?
Oh, Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, I don't like want to brag or anything, but I kind of landed my first big interview last night.
Ooh.
My nephew
Ooh.
called. I'm the subject of his essay for school. So
Oh.
I had to do a whole interview impromptu about writing and talking to his favorite author, Peter Brown. So yeah, like I mean, you know, I'm a pretty big deal in the family now.
That's awesome.
That is fun, though. I like that.
Yeah, it was very surprising because they just called me out of the blue. I had no idea. And then he said that, and I just thought, like, at first I was just like, oh, there's no one else more interesting you to write about. Okay, fine. But yeah, he listened to the Peter Brown interview, and
Oh.
he heard me say his name. Yeah, I'm a pretty big deal in that household right now.
How old is your nephew?
Nice.
He is 11, I think.
Aw, that's so cute.
Yeah,
So
I
see,
could.
he's into Wild Robot, right?
Yeah, he really enjoyed it. He liked the book, and so the question, before I even knew I was going to interview Peter Brown, my brother had texted me because Deccan had questions about why Mama Bear and the Two Bears weren't in the movie, you know, because they made
Yeah.
the Mark Hamill character the one grumpy bear, and the Mama Bear and the two cubs were his favorite characters in the book, so he was quite upset. So I told them a bit about why I speculated that would happen, and then I asked Peter and used Deccan's name to preface the question, so he thought that was very cool.
Nice.
Peter Brown hit it out of the park with that one. Like that is hitting so many different age groups. And like I haven't read the books, but my wife has the audiobook in her Jeep. So whenever we go somewhere as a family, my daughter makes us put that on. So I've heard you hear enough of it, you can tell how much they had to take out and what they left in and stuff like that. But yeah, I mean, like everybody, like every age group seems to be into this thing from elementary right up to middle school.
He's a big Star Wars fan, but so he's reading a bit above his age, but it's largely because, well, I mean, you know, my brother's a big reader and so is his mom, but they were reading books out loud, so they, you know, moved quickly on to reading kind of more complicated books when he was younger for bedtime. So so it
Nice.
was, you know, I mean, you know, it's my first
Cool.
big interview.
Very cool.
Big deal.
Congratulations. All right, JP, standing in for Kevin. What is in the news?
All right, in the news, if you're missing the old NaNoWriMo, there's always try Novel November. Novel November is a free global 50,000 words in 30 days challenge hosted by Pro Writing Aid with AuthorNation as a partner. Support includes daily writing sprints, a lively community, and 150 plus live craft and Q&A sessions with mentors like Madeline Miller, Tommy Adeyemi, Rufy Thorpe, and Jessica Brody. Every word supports room to read, plus in-person morning sprints and story hangout at Author Nation in Las Vegas.
I've never done NaNoWriMo or anything like. Have you guys ever tried it? Like just sit
No.
down and crank out 50,000.
Yeah,
No.
JP's nodding over there.
JP's done it. Yeah.
Yeah, I've done it. I did it when I had the day job, and like it was tough, but yeah, there was a lot of dictation that was involved. Did I ever do anything with that? No, but it at least got me into like the practice, so.
That would be tough with a day job because that's what, about 1600 words a day, right?
Just over. Yeah.
Wow.
I've never done it. I always find it intimidating. Like, I like the idea of it in the community, but I'm like, that's a lot of words.
Did somebody actually own NaNoWriMo, like a trademark or something on it? I'm not sure why they're rebranding under a different name or if they're just trying to play it safe.
Yeah, I think they probably, with everything that happened with NaNoWriMo, don't want to be associated, would be my guess.
Yeah, and I would think
Yeah, it
that the
could be that.
domain is still owned by, unless they sold it off. So there would be a lot of difficulty, at least in terms of like using the actual acronym.
Got it.
But this is cool. I mean, like I'm slightly shouting out my own thing, but like Dialogue Doctor, we're doing something like this that we've done 4 times now. We do it in the spring and in October, called the Dialogue Dash. And so I like that there are other opportunities for people as well. But this is a great opportunity because I think that there's a lot of energy around NaNoWriMo, especially in beginner authors, and just having that completely fade into nothing is, I think, a little detrimental because I think there's something about that energy that I'm glad other people are picking up.
Well, it's a cool sprint to run, you know, like if you're, you know, especially if you are working the day job, you know, if you can afford to do it, somehow take off a week or two in November and, you know, you crank out, even if it's a crappy rough draft, at least you've got a rough draft that you can play with because and you knocked it out fast enough and then you just have to clean it up and tweak it. So it's a fantastic exercise.
I do like the idea because I think like the most important thing, I know people get focused on like that 50,000 words, but like I honestly think if you're gonna do any kind of like writing challenge like this, it's just to get in the habit of finding where you can write every day. So like, you know, once you start kind of getting into that habit, it's a lot easier to sustain it, you know, into December and January. So I think that's don't worry about the words, especially if you're working full time. Like, just get into that, find the time, and then do it that way, I think.
Next up, YouTube is inching closer to becoming a shopping channel. YouTube is adding shopping tools, swappable brand segments in long videos so creators can resell ad slots, shoppable links in shorts, and top fans exclusive merch test rolling out from late 2024 through 2026. New AI product tagging will auto-identify items shown or mentioned in videos and link where to buy, reaching eligible U.S. creators over the next year. Videos are turning into storefronts, giving creators more direct commerce revenue across shorts, long form, and live streams.
There you
And
go.
this scares me because, like, in my head, like I picture, remember pop-up video? Like back in the day, like that's how I see TV like evolving. Like you'll be watching a sitcom, and like I can see little pop-up boxes popping up. Like if you want to buy this woman's sweater, if you want to buy this book in the background, if you want to buy this, just click here. And like all that stuff is kind of coming. And like we use Sling TV for our live channels, and probably about a third of their commercials now have the option, you know, the ability to actually buy straight from the, you know, the commercial itself. So like it is spreading fast.
I mean, as someone who uses TikTok Shop, I like this because it just makes it so that I can do this elsewhere. It's sort of the same on Instagram. You can, or like Meta platforms, you can link your shop, like your direct sales, and that way when you do posts, you can sort of have a way for anyone who watches that to be like, oh, this is interesting, to find a quick and easy way to get it instead of having to leave the platform, search something, hopefully grab it. So it just reduces the click through. But I agree that like at some point it's like, oh no, as a consumer, like I can buy it immediately. You know, you're gonna get a lot of that like impulse buy.
I think it's what we talked about like last week with Spotify. Every platform is becoming everything and doing everything else the other platforms are doing. So yeah, I think they're probably trying to compete with TikTok and Instagram would be my guess.
What are those like the economic, there's like economic waves and it's like what you'll the world, it cycles through people becoming generalists and then become specialists, and then it goes back to generalists, and we're definitely going to the generalists. And I personally am a little bit am more looking forward to going back to specialist. I
Same.
think generalist is just, it just gets to be too much. 'Cause I mean, like, it's one thing when it's like, you know, you can go straight to an author and like buy their books, especially if they have a shop and they do like signed copies or things like that. Like, that's pretty cool. But like, man, I don't trust anything influencers put on their pages. Like, there's no way I'm just gonna click. I don't care how easy you make it. In fact, the easier you make it, the more suspicious I am of the product, to be honest. So I don't know, man. It's the weird world we live in.
For sure.
Last up in the news, Amazon adds Benetech accessible metadata to ebooks. Amazon now shares an accessibility tab on Kindle book pages for titles that meet Benetech's global certified accessible standard, making it easier for readers using screen readers or with dyslexia to find usable ebooks. Simon & Schuster is the only Big Five house with GCA certification. It's moving to 100% born accessible ebooks in 2025 and upgrading its backlist of about 3,600 so far, aiming to make all active titles accessible by 2030. Accessibility is becoming a competitive edge and a legal must. We have the EU Accessibility Act expanding ADA rules, pushing publishers to build alternative text for other features into workflows from the start.
This is cool.
I don't even know where to start with this. Are you guys doing this, or like, do we have to do anything to comply with it? Or
Oh, I
I've
don't
never
know.
heard of it, honestly, until
You're the
today.
Simon and Schuster guy. I thought you would know all about it.
I have never even heard of this before, up until this story popped in my email box today.
Yeah,
Yeah,
I don't know. It's
so.
kind of neat that it's like easier accessibility and that Simon and Schuster is number one with this, so they might be getting some sales on it, and I'm sure the other ones will be coming along as well. I love the dyslexia thing. I was seeing they're advertising some kind of font where it was bolding like the first letter, two letters, and a couple letters. And it was amazing as myself, who's not dyslexic, how fast I could read that font. I was like, can you put this font on all of my stuff? Because I was like speed reading. That was
Yeah.
awesome. Yeah.
I had just listened to something about this, and I've sort of been aware of it because of one of the books I had to upload. But with the whole EU Accessibility Act, the big thing for writers is like if you have images in your books and you are the one working through it, you really need to consider if those need alternative text. And then there's also a feature when you upload those books onto Amazon and I believe Ingram that states like a checkbox that states whether or not you have that in your books. And if you don't, there is the risk that in the future, if this becomes something that the gets pushed more, that Amazon will then not push your books out to the EU unless you update it. So it can be a little tough, but I think that you know, if you're using programs like Atticus, it's already there for you to, in your images, have the alternative text. And then you just need to sort of educate yourself on how to do that and what works best for describing it for people who can't necessarily see the image or may have difficulty interpreting the image.
You know, my writer brain is like playing with this as a thriller. Like I could use the alt text in an image as part of the storyline somehow.
No,
You know,
that'd
like
be really
almost like
cool.
hidden, little hidden clues.
You got
That
to get
would.
Alex to cut that out so you can be first.
Oh, I mean,
Yeah.
you'd have to
Comfortable
be
with your secret.
careful because you still need to be compliant with whatever the alternative text is intended for. But if you could do that and still put in like the
That'd be
clues,
very cool.
that's the key.
That was very cool.
You have a story. Share it with the world. Ingram Spark offers everything you need to publish, promote, sell, and print your book. Reach millions of readers worldwide with powerful tools created for independent authors. Get started for free at ingramspark.com/learn more.
All right. With that, JD, who is up this week?
This week we've got Johnny B. Truant on. Johnny's the best-selling author of Fat Vampire, which was adopted by the Sci-Fi Channel. Other books include Pretty Killers and Invasion and many others. He's here to tell us about his latest nonfiction title called The Artisan Author, the low-stress, high-quality, fan-focused approach to escaping the publishing rat race, which comes out November 4th. Here he is, Johnny B. Truant.
I am always happy to chat with Johnny B. Truant. We're practically neighbors, although it takes us an hour to get to, our mutual stomping grounds, I guess, here in the Austin area.
Maybe a half hour if we meet in the
Half
middle.
hour. Well, it takes us each a half hour.
Yeah, it's an hour total.
Not too bad though, in terms of Texas. Like, in Texas, you don't measure anything in miles. You measure it in the amount of time it takes you to drive there. That's an American thing, I think. Is that America in
That's
general?
interesting. I thought we measured things in degrees above 90.
Yeah, that's the other side of it. So, you and I go way back, and yeah, you're actually some of your background here, and you wrote me a nice little bio that I'm not going to read out loud, but it'll get used at some point. But I like how you framed it that you are one of indie publishing's early authorities. Which is true because you and Sean Platt and David Wright were the hosts of the original self-publishing podcast for years. How long did that show run? You know?
Well, that's a little like asking how long Happy Days ran before Fonzie jumped the shark. So, like, the technical answer is longer. We had, let's see, so we started it in 2012. I want to say 2012. There's some podcast karma for you. And I would say until 20, let's see, this first Smart Artist Summit, which was our live event, was I think 2016. 16, no, it was 15. So anyway, so I would say that up until 15 or 16 were our glory years. Those, like, say 4 years. After that,
it became a little harder to, our uniqueness was that we didn't know a lot of stuff and we were figuring out along the way.
Yeah.
And when people started coming in more and more, now this is of course accepting Joanna Penn, who always had her stuff together and always knew.
I'm pretty sure she was born. Else, yeah.
She was born knowing self-publishing. She was in it way before us. But there were so many people coming in who were frankly doing it better, who were prepared, who were talking to a lot of the same guests. And while we're saying, how does that work? People are getting on and saying, here's how it works.
Yeah.
And so at that point, it just became, we lost a lot of our rhythm. And I think we dragged along until 2018 or 19. But by then we were like, well, how should we reinvent this show? So yeah, I would say the glory years were, say, 4 or 5 solid years of SVP glory.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm proud to have been a returning guest, occasional returning guest on the show.
Yeah, we would have called you like a series regular.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. At one point before I was a guest at all, you referred to me, you guys did like a live stream and I popped on and asked a question and you called me an OG listener, I think. I'm like, I'm gonna get on that show, damn it. I'm gonna be more than just a listener on that show. So.
Definitely OG. It was fun that we had a very small brand of very, very niche fame in that time. And that was kind of fun because people, you know, when you have a podcast, I mean, you would know this, people listen to it and it's that, I forget the phrase right now, where it's like they think they know you and you don't know them. It's some parasocial relationship, usually what they call that.
Yeah.
And so we had people all the time that it was like, oh, I can't believe I'm talking to you guys. And I'm like, I'm just some idiot who sits down behind a microphone in my office.
Right.
But yeah, that's cool to hear. And you were.
You could have run into me at HEB. It would have been the same experience. It's just.
The exact same experience. Let me interview you here in the produce aisle.
We should do that sometime. So, all right. Let's back up a little because you didn't just start life with the self-publishing podcast. You and Sean, I don't know when Dave came into the mix. I'm not sure of the.
Dave was with
there.
Sean before I got there. They were a pre-existing couple that I then elbowed.
That's right. I think I did know that. But you had been writing. Let's talk about your origin story as a writer. Like when did this despicable habit of yours get its start?
I have been trying to kick it most of my life. I mean, it's like a lot of writers. I think I've always written, and it was just a matter of when did it become serious, when did it become professional. And so I just remember being very young and like working on my grandmother's old, like literal typewriter where you had to hit keys and there was a ribbon and all that stuff that young people today don't know. And I went through the querying agents sort of a phase. I know that that's still a thing, but it's like
still
not
a thing.
As much of a thing. But that was like, you know, you had to write an actual physical letter and put it in the mail and send it out to agents. And I went around to conferences and actually tried to network my way through agents. But then it was like, well, there was just kind of no way to do it then practically. And I mean, yeah, you could. I know people who've been successful at that. But it was so much harder. And it just like life got in the way. And after dozens and dozens of rejections for my first book, I just kind of gave up. And ended up going into grad school for genetics, which is my original career trajectory. And it wasn't until digital self-publishing came back around and I was blogging and I ran into Sean Platt, who was making a go of this with his partner, David Wright, that I kind of thought, oh, let me shoehorn my way in there. Let me see if I can elbow in with these guys and try to learn the trade. And then it was, the rest was history, as they say.
Yeah. Yeah. Was Bialy Pimps, was that your first book?
That was, yes, the Bialy Pimps.
Did I get it right?
It's a tale of fame and baked goods. Yes, you did.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah. I remember you talking about that book a lot in the early days of the podcast. That's where that came from. I just thought it was an interesting title.
It is funny to think back. Yeah, it is funny because I just wrote this book, The Artist and Author, and it required some retrospection. And I've written some posts recently that have me looking back.
Yeah.
And it's interesting from the place that the industry has gotten to look back at those kind of naive, simple times in my career, where I just remember kind of like coming on with maybe a little more swagger than I had any right to, with like, well, you know, my book is finished and ready. And it was just one book and it was a standalone and it's not at all commercial. But, you know, we kind of didn't think in those terms back in the day. I mean, maybe some real forward thinkers did, but I certainly didn't.
No, commercial. Who thinks commercial? These days, maybe a little more. Maybe I have a little bit. I don't know. I don't think so, actually. I just write the thing that I want to read, and then I think you're pretty much the same, right? You just kind of.
Well, I mean, I did just write a whole book about that philosophy. So, yeah,
Yeah,
100%.
yeah. We're going to talk about it. I want to work this in somehow, though, because and I want to discuss it, and then I want us to move straight into the artists and stuff because that's the real reason we're here. But you wrote a book called Fat Vampire, which is now expanded into a series, right? Like
It's a series. It's a six book series with a four book side series.
I sound so ignorant. But the interesting thing about that book and series was that Sci-Fi actually picked that up for its series, Reginald the Vampire. That's interesting. We've talked about this before on my show, but you want to give a real quick rundown of how that ended up happening?
That was one of those random, well, it wasn't random, but it wasn't planned either, sort of things where, one day I got an email, or maybe it was a call, I don't remember, from somebody who was interested. And it was actually a guy with the BBC of all places. And I had gotten inquiries about Fat Vampire before because, I think I calculated it's had 1 million downloads or something like that. So it's out there. People knew it, and it's got this catchy title. And he was just a connection maker, the guy who contacted me. They didn't want it for the BBC. Ended up connecting me with some Hollywood friends of his who were looking for a project. One of them was Harley Payton, who was showrunner for Twin Peaks, and the other was Jeremiah Chechik, who directed Christmas Vacation and Benny and June and a few other things. So it was this kind of weird mishmash of like quirky, offbeat, whatever that they had together. And they were very interested in this project and took a few years. It was optioned first and went all the way through to greenlit, kind of without a hitch, which looking back is kind of shocking
A
that it didn't
miracle,
have any troubles. Yeah, I mean it didn't get mired in development hell or anything like that. And they shot two seasons. I don't know if there will be a third. I mean that's a long lifespan on that, but Sci-Fi canceled pretty much all of its scripted programming about a year ago, including really popular shows that they had no reason to cancel. So who knows? It could come back, but I did get two solid seasons, and I don't mean to blow anyone's mind here and make anybody starstruck, but I am uncredited guy in window for like up to
Oh,
4
nice.
seconds in the
All
first
right.
episode. Yeah.
That beats my cameo in Tin Cup.
In Tin Cup.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, knew
My
it.
elbow, my forearm and elbow in Tin Cup. So that's cool, man. Yeah, that's always something people want to hear about. And there's a lot of illusions, I think, or perhaps delusions around getting your book turned into something like a show or a film or whatever.
Yeah.
What do you think is like the biggest, I don't know. I don't want to turn this into a downer, but I do want people to realize like it's not always everything is cracked up to be, but like what was the thing that maybe upset your expectations a little when it came to that?
Well, I mean, I hate to pivot on your question, but nothing. But the
Okay.
reason is because I was very, I've always been very, always, since this project happened, which was a handful of years, it's their thing. And it's not my thing. And I think the best way to look at them is they're cousins. Because the way that I like to look at this is, let's say you did a quote faithful adaptation, the sort of thing where nobody can complain that anything was changed. The book itself is about 35,000 words, which means that if you were to read it, literally read it, it would take about 4 hours on an audiobook. So there's plenty of room, is what I'm saying. Like they had 10 hours to fill for the first season alone, and the first book followed the first season. And so I knew it was never going to be exact, and you have to fill out side stories. Most TV is not a single character the entire time. Like usually you flip back and forth. And I had stuck with Reginald, the main character, all the time. Like if it's limited third person, meaning that if he doesn't experience it, you don't know what happened. And so the TV being the medium it is had to fill out these other stories for other characters. And so it was already going to be different. And so when they made changes on top of that, then I didn't really care. And that really served me because when I went in with that attitude, oh my God, did it open them up, the people involved, because they knew I wasn't going to be a pain about it.
Always good to keep the people who control the outcome happy, I guess.
Now, I will say, as a pivot on that question, that this wasn't disappointing at all, but it was a little different than I think you'd think, and I probably could have predicted this difference, but it was still interesting. And it is that it's just a business, mm-hmm. and I think that we see things on TV, and where there's a pedestal that most people tend to put TV and film up onto because, oh, I have seen you on the Magic Box in my right. living room. But just realizing that these are all just people doing a job was really cool, and was really like, there was even going in and knowing that, there was still a visceral click that had to happen for me to really kind of get it, that there's nothing special here. This is just people doing a job, and they're good at what they do, just like I'm good at what I do.
Yeah. Well, all right. Speaking of good at what you do, let's, and speaking of pivoting, let's pivot.
Yes.
So you and I, both sort of on our own, accidentally tapped into the same general idea. I think they refer to that as a zeitgeist, Johnny, that,
could be
this idea of the artisan mindset, the artisan approach to novel writing or any form of writing. Let's talk about the book first. Like what's the book that you're releasing? What's it called again?
It's called The Artisan Author. And, I'm actually going to, dethrone us a little bit on that because yes, we did reach this independently, and you've talked about it and I've talked about it,
yeah.
But I don't think either of us, well, you said zeitgeist. So you've already,
kind yeah, I don't, we do. I didn't just come up with it. I guess I think it's a movement. I think there's something.
Well, it gave me a box that I could put some thoughts into that. Yeah. It allowed me to articulate it. Once I started thinking, okay, well, we're artisan creators, and it's not just the production, it's end to end. It's how you approach a career as an artisan, as opposed to somebody who's basically working the way that big business does.
Yeah.
And that in itself is not meant as any sort of a disparagement. You can be a small operator and still work like a big business, and there's nothing wrong with that.
Right.
But this is more like it's intentionally more of a one-to-one, more of a one-at-a-time, more of a slow creation sort of a thing. And it's kind of like if you were to go buy jewelry from Zales at the mall,
right,
or you were to go to a local artisan fair and found somebody who smithed silver by hand or something like that. It's kind of that difference. And once I started thinking, once I had that box and thought, okay, maybe I'm an artisan author, and I put that label on it, then a lot of other things started to make sense. And maybe you have a similar story, right? You make decisions differently once you've realized that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, what was it? What triggered it for you? What made you decide this is it?
Well, I have a whole little story here. I have a whole little tale.
Luckily, we have a podcast to fill. So,
it's storytellers on this podcast. So, a little bit of backstory. So, I worked with, I mentioned Sean Platt and David Wright from the Self Publishing podcast. And Sean had a company called Sterling and Stone that basically became a little publisher. And we were partners in that. Sean and I were kind of partners in that. And it became apparent over several years that Sean was much more of an entrepreneur than I was, a more like a solo operator. And that company, you know, grew and had other people. But as part of that, my role in it, I shrunk my role. I was going to say my role shrunk, but it's more like if I'm not in the driver's seat of everything, my natural tendency is to pull back and wait to be told what to do, which is, right. I don't even like that. It's just what happens. And so I was in this position where it was like, okay, just keep producing stuff, Johnny, and we'll handle everything. We'll do the covers, we'll do the blurbs, we'll do the email list, we'll do everything. And all I had to do was write. And that sounded great, but it wasn't. Turns out I really need the other stuff. So after a handful of years of that, Sean and I reached the conclusion that we really kind of shouldn't have been business partners. It was probably never right to begin with. It was great in the time, but the time had reached its end, and we had what I call an amicable business divorce. So we're still good friends. We still write together, but mm-hmm. we know we shouldn't be in business together. So when that happened, I got back a lot of my books, and I decided, okay, well, I need to go back out into the world because I'm no longer part of Sterling and Stone. Now I'm Johnny B. Truant, solo author, and I didn't yet have this artisan designation in mind.
Yeah.
So I went to the last 20 Books to 50K conference, which was held in 2023 in November in Vegas. Just because, and it was almost on a lark, like I almost didn't go because like I had to pay, you know, a lot of times I've been a speaker before, I had to buy plane tickets and a ticket to the event and a hotel room. But I said, okay, if I'm going out there again and I'm going to no longer be this backseat author, I'm going to go out and I'm going to do a conference because I always love those. And at that conference, it was like being thrown back into cold water after you've gotten used to being in the air.
Right.
And I just remember being like, oh my God, this industry has changed so much in the few years that I've been out of the spotlight. Like, I wasn't going to conferences. I wasn't talking to other people. I was just in my cave. And when I came in, you know, AI was brand new. People were just starting to really talk about using AI to write books. Rapid release had really matured. I'm not a fan of rapid release, so it pains me to say matured. Let's say it got more rapid.
Yeah.
And it just became evolved. It evolved. It became very much an entrenched business practice for the people who did it. And, you know, all sorts of other stuff had changed. And I was like looking at it with like this mindset of what if I was new? Like I couldn't help but.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, oh my God, this is so overwhelming. And it's overwhelming to me. Even though I had at the time, you know, over 100 books, it felt overwhelming. And I was like, how can I don't even know if I want to do this. Mm. And it felt like there was this dichotomy between you can either keep going the path that most of the industry is going, which it definitely was going that way in that conference. That's the way it felt. And you can make a lot of money, but man, there's a lot of moving parts. You got to move super fast. It's stressful. You might not be a fit for it, but you got to churn out content. Or you can write your own way, do your own thing and be broke.
Yeah.
And I say that this is like the Whopper computer in War Games, where after playing all the thermonuclear war situations, it said the only winning move is not to play.
Yeah.
And that's kind of how I felt. I was like, do I want to play this game anymore? And then after thinking about it after that conference, it was like, oh, I think there might be another way. And it was before the first Author Nation in 2024 that I kind of get this idea of this artisan authoring thing and how it could be a business that works under a totally different paradigm than the rapid release paradigm, but just as valid to the point where you can earn in a totally different way that a lot of people aren't doing and that personally is better suited to someone like me and you, apparently.
Yeah. Well, what is this paradigm then? What's the shift that you've made?
Well, let's talk about the need for a paradigm to begin with.
Okay.
Because there's a lot about rapid release that bugs me.
Yeah.
And the reason that it bugs me is not because people are doing it. Like, I don't think there's anything wrong with people who are truly, truly right for it. There's a few things I think that bug me. One is because I think it's presented almost as a default. Mm-hmm. And there are plenty of people who are not right for it who end up in it anyway because they don't know there's an alternative. And the other, the tenants that are taken as for granted in rapid release.
Right.
If you think about them, if you enumerate the things that rapid release acts as if these things are true and they are true within that world, they don't make any sense once you move out of the rapid release world. So within it makes sense. You try to take those same principles and say, I'm not going to do the crazy rapid release thing. It's too much for me, but I'm going to subconsciously borrow those things that are true in that world and bring them out. That's when it falls apart. And so I'm talking about things like price your books at 99 cents are free. I'm talking about worrying about quantity more than quantity. Like, you can have quality as a rapid releaser, but if you have a choice between the two and your books are going to tank if you don't get a release out, quantity has to come first.
Yeah.
Building a fan base is kind of overrated. I know there are plenty of people who build fan bases in Kindle Unlimited, but usually that's not a portable fan base. Usually it's a fan base that needs to stay in KU. And there's a bunch of things like that once you move them into the real world of like real business, they just don't make any sense. So when the reason that I thought like we need to talk about this paradigm thing is because you need to understand that you're operating under a fundamentally different way of doing business.
Right.
You are in a different world, serving different customers, and you need to stop thinking in terms of those rapid release ways of thinking if you aren't one of those authors, if you're operating in this world. And I'll just give you an example. The way that we are all kind of taught by default to gain new customers is to put a book up on Amazon and maybe other places, and then to do certain things to attempt to juice the algorithms so that our book will be shown to more people and we will see an increase in sales in our dashboards. And there's a bunch of things we can do. We can do categories, we can do keywords, we can do advertising, we can segment reader lists so that we're really, really targeting those same people so that we teach the algorithms. But in the artisan approach, you kind of, the algorithms kind of don't matter. And right. instead, you're looking for individual people who aren't necessarily even being served by those algorithms. They're like authors who might not even be on Amazon. And once that clicks, then it's like, okay, I understand everything that I've been taking for granted is I need to do it to juice the algorithms. It doesn't really matter. You know, people will say, okay, so I've written about this a bunch. And they'll be like, okay, so you're saying price your books higher, right? Like price your books at what I think they're worth. I don't think an ebook is worth 99 cents. I think it's worth a lot more than that.
Right.
But
right.
within rapid release or Kindle Unlimited, that does work because you need to lower the prices in order to get more people from that environment, those customers to buy so that it juices the algorithms.
Right.
And when you realize that you are no longer worried about the algorithms, then suddenly it's like, oh, okay. I guess I can raise my prices because I need to kick my head out of my old way of thinking.
That whole 99-cent low-priced book model is kind of the reason you have to use rapid release in the first place. Because, you know, in order to entice the people who are rabid about it, who are avid readers who read voraciously, you know, they're not going to be able to spend $10 per book or more or whatever. So they're going to have to, you're going to have to price lower. And so if you're going to make a living, that means you got to have more books and you got to, you know, constantly churn, basically.
I want people to know what game they're playing.
Yeah.
Like if you want to play that game, then.
Yeah. I think you and I both benefited from that game for much of our writing careers. I know that I did. I mean, I think that was the model that Sterling and Stone was using though, right? Was a kind of.
Well, they have a mixed bag and I don't want to speak for them, but we're old school enough. And when I say we, I mean, both of us to have been there before Kindle Unlimited. I remember when Kindle Unlimited was debuted.
Yeah.
And so the idea of pricing low was originally like a soft version of juicing the algorithms. You know, when Ed Robertson came on in the early episodes and told us for the first time about algorithms, like I hadn't heard that before in the way that he described it. It was like, oh, that's a way I can get my book in front of more readers. And it was just a slow, slippery slope between, oh, I can do something particular to attract readers, which in Ed's mind, I don't think was 99-cent pricing or anything. I think it was just better targeting.
Right.
Then it seemed like, okay, well, so there's a new thing we can do to make those algorithms work even better.
Yeah.
What if we ran cheap ads? Oh, what if we price pulsed between 99 cents and full price? And what if it's 99 cents all the time? What if the first one is free? Like those things happened sequentially. And it's kind of like we didn't realize what we were getting into until we looked back and said, oh, wait, that made sense at the beginning. It makes no sense now.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, everything's evolved. You know, Kindle, even the Kindle platform has evolved. It's no longer as effective, I think. You know, I get some pushback on this, but I actually remember doing a podcast. I think I was doing the Author Nation podcast, and I was talking to Joe, and I said something about how, you know, in my experience, I'm getting pushback. If I release too rapidly, I actually have readers who are starting to accuse me of using AI to write the book. I guess not quite realizing, like, there was a point in my life where I was doing a book every 15 days, where I did a book in one day one time. And so that, you know, to me, that was a shift in the tide. But I got immediate pushback from authors who are like, readers don't do that. They don't think like that. Like, I did qualify this saying it was my experience.
Well, yeah. So two things to say on that, and I've already forgotten what one of them is that I think that there's an experience there. This is part of the paradigm shift.
Yeah.
Is the artist and author is targeting what I just call artists and readers. I don't know that that shoe fits entirely. It's just an easier way to talk about the readers who are attracted to artists and authors.
Right. Right.
And those readers, I mean, there's a certain wanting to savor the anticipation. It's a little like if I, you know, every once in a while, my wife and I'll go out to a really nice restaurant. It's not very often, like for our anniversary or something. And if the food comes too fast, it bugs me. Yeah. I'm like, take your time. Give me a long time with my glasses of wine and the little, you know, garlic, the bread that you can dip in the olive oil and stuff. Right. If they bring that food too soon, I'm like, this is the only night I'm going out and being fancy. And you're rushing me. Like, I don't like that.
Yeah.
And I think that that artisan reader has that attitude. And the second point, because I remembered it, was I should probably clarify that, I mean, I'm largely presenting the artisan author approach as an alternative to rapid release for the people who can't tolerate the rapid release thing, like me. But because it's a counter to rapid release, there's a real tendency to think, oh, so it's going slow. Mm-hmm. And the answer is maybe, maybe not. You can, it's the order of priority. So I actually do write really fast when I'm, when I'm in writing mode, which I'm not currently. But that's my flow. And I would never artificially rush a project to publication because it had to fit a market demand. So one, I have these like pillars of being an artisan author. And one of them is art first, profit second.
Right.
You'll notice that profit is not never, it's second. It just means that if you have a choice between making an artistic decision and a profit one, at least most of the time, at least during the creation phase, let's say, the creation phase, not the marketing phase, then you should choose art. And if you choose the art, then that's an artisan decision. Mm-hmm. And so whether you go fast, whether you go slow, it really kind of doesn't matter. It just means that you don't have to go fast. It's not a requirement to survive that you go fast.
Yeah. That's the hardest shift, I think, in what you're talking about. Because right now, you know, the if you want to be a full-time writer, if that's the goal, if that's why you started doing this, and for most of us, that's true, right? You know, the money is important because the money is how you afford all the food and electricity and all the things that actually support you in doing this. So that's the first question anybody asks. It's like, you know, what do I do about income?
Well, let me do a Becca Syme here and question the premise, right?
All right.
So I'm going to push back a little on that's what most of us want. I think that may be true. It may be true that most people want to be full-time authors, but I have this strong suspicion that if you count all writers who want to publish a book, I'll bet it's a minority who want to be full-time or who think that they're going to be full-time.
Yeah.
What do you think of that? Do you think I'm off
base? I don't disagree with it. I mean, I think I think that a lot of people who think they want to be full-time writers, I think they've painted that a pretty rosy color, and they don't realize, you know, there's a lot. It's not just about, like, let's just say that your books are making a phenomenal income and you can afford to just, you know, sit there and write all day long. Most people aren't going to. Most people are going to kind of lose their minds. You know, you and I had lunch with David Veergoods. This was exactly his point. That, you know, most people are going to write for an hour or two a day, and then the rest of their day, they're just going to fill with something. So I think a lot of writers maybe don't, they think they do. I think everybody should get the opportunity to try it for like 3 months to 6 months. And then when you start having like the existential crisis, which is inevitable, I think I enjoy it. I like being full-time, but you know.
But you and I and people aspiring to full time, I think, are a unique breed. And we are, and I say this lovingly, kind of an arrogant breed, meaning that like you have to think that you are so great that you're gonna make a living at this.
Right.
But you know, I think of people like my wife. Now, she's not a writer, but if she was a writer, she would never want to be full time because it makes her nervous, because the idea of, you know, being that whimsical with your income and not being able to count on a paycheck would drive her nuts.
Yeah.
And I know people who they just love their day jobs and they don't want to quit. But I think that our culture, and when I say our culture, I mean our self-publishing culture, has put that out there as this is the default. And the question doesn't become, do you want to be a full-time writer? It becomes, how do you want to become a full-time writer, or how can you? Mm-hmm. Rather than just stepping back and saying, but do you want it?
Right. That's a hard question for authors, I think. That's a tough one. I mean, because, you know, if you right off the top, most of us are kind of, well, I'll say indoctrinated, I guess, into that idea, right? Like we are, of course, we want to be a full time. We want, I guess, you really need to define what it means to you to be a full time writer. Does it mean that you sit for 10 hours a day writing and you know, you're squinting, you know, whatever at the screen by the end of the day? Or is it, you know, I want to be able to write for 2 hours and then go to museums or libraries or, you know, or whatever, and spend the rest of my day researching? You know, you need to define what it all means. And then you'll start to kind of narrow it down to like, what are you really after? I know plenty, there's authors, a lot of the authors I know, and Christine Daigle, one of the co-hosts of this show, love their day jobs and don't want to change the day job. They just want to be able to, I think most of us, what we really want is FU money.
A little bit. Yeah, yeah. I'll bet that most of those writers who say they don't need to be full-time, if it somehow happened, you had something just take off, like mm-hmm. almost without your volition, I don't think people would turn it down.
Right.
And I'll bet a good number of people would quit jobs, even who said they love their day job.
Almost every writer that I've known who ultimately went full-time also started doing something. They created a small business. They created some side hustle.
Yeah.
You know, because the writing wasn't enough. It's not that it's not fulfilling. It's just that, you know, it does for a lot of us, you know, a 4-hour writing day is a long day for a lot of writers. I'll sit here for 8 to 10 hours. I got no problem with it, but you know, most people aren't going to be able to do that. And so they want to fill their time with something else. So.
Yeah. Well, I think that the kind of 7-figure author crowd or 6-figure author crowd, like those have become buzzwords and they're loud. Right. Because those are the people that everybody's asking, how did you do it? Or wanting to share or whatever. And so we have a disproportionate number of people who are on YouTube or podcasts or conference stages or whatever, sharing their journeys of becoming 6 or 7-figure authors. Yeah. And so just like that, the thing about what I was saying earlier, it starts to feel like that is the default. That is the only way. And you start to realize like there's a lot of people, I think, who just, they just want to publish a book or two.
Yeah.
It's creatively fulfilling for them. And they're like, man, you know, if nobody read this, I'd be happy. But if I could make, you know, a couple hundred dollars, if I could make my car payment on it, that would be amazing.
Yeah.
And I just, I grate against this feeling that we have to be, it's all or nothing.
Right.
It's all or nothing with rapid release. It's all or nothing with full time. And so that's what I'm trying to say. Like, how does it not need to be all or nothing?
The artisan paradigm. All right, man. Well, we're out of time, so I'm gonna have to wrap us up. But
all right,
when
we should be on another podcast.
Yeah, we'll have to. We'll follow this one up on the Wordslinger. Are you? When's the book release? Do you know? Do you have a date?
The book comes out in Kickstarter July. Well, the Kickstarter begins July 15th. It runs through August 14th. But of course, nature Kickstarter. You know, you get it at the end. The official launch date wide is November 4th.
Okay.
And the link to both, you want me to give a link to both?
Sure. Do what you got to do, man.
All right. It's johnnybtruant.com/artisan. So it'll be to the Kickstarter before that ends and it'll be to the book after it ends.
Good deal, man. Well, good luck with it. I think it's a timely topic and a timely concept. Obviously,
I think so too. Obviously,
I've done like 10 talks called artisan author or artisan something or another. So,
yeah,
we're on the same page.
100%.
All right, man. Thanks a lot.
I'm curious, was there ever a time that you had more swagger as an author than you should have?
Ooh. Go ahead. You go first.
I was thinking about this. I'm like, not swagger, but with the first book I had published with my co-author, we got tickets to World Fantasy from our publisher. And I went into the writer's lounge and I was just shooting the breeze with like authors. And I did not know this guy from anything. And we had like a whole conversation about gin. And I'm like, yeah, I'm cool. And I later found out that Garth Nix is kind of a big deal. So I was like, I didn't know who that was. We just sat down. He likes Settler's Gin with Rosemary. I found that out, but I don't think they have that in North America. I haven't seen it anywhere. So
I've always got more swagger than I deserve. So I don't know that I'm the right person to go to.
Yeah, I think I wonder if that's like a male versus female thing. I can definitely see. I don't know. I just generally don't. And this isn't a lack of confidence thing. So I know that that's how it's going to sound. It's just that I generally am like, I mean, I have thoughts and opinions, but like, what do I know? Like, I don't know anything. So I think like, I just have like this really weird, like, I just do things and I'm like, is it good? I have no idea. I don't know if that's swagger or not. Like querying never intimidated me in the way, like I just, I went to my first like conference after writing a terrible book and like live pitched agents because I just had no idea what I was doing. So I didn't even know. I don't think that's swagger. I think that's just like maybe stupidity.
Ignorance. Like, we don't know what we're doing. This is fine. This is good.
But I guess doing that and like how nice everyone was and that they, were very kind in their feedback. Like one was a terrible pitch and she's like, let me stop you right there. And she asked a few questions. She goes, now redo it and say it this way. So like it was like very eye-opening and a learning experience for me. So I don't know. I don't think it was swagger. I think I just am not afraid to just like go headfirst into things that I have no idea about.
I would say like swagger is like the hard, I don't know if I have that, well, probably, but like especially doing TikTok and having to really learn how to refine a pitch as fast as possible to grab people means that like I can rattle off like a hook really quick to people. And so like when I do in-person events, I do have the confidence to be able to say like the pitch, and I'll know based off of your response whether or not you're interested. But yeah, like I think that maybe if you wanted to ask, maybe that's it. I don't know.
That's cool.
There's a fine line between confidence and swagger.
I agree with that. What that line is varies per person too, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, let's pivot. Do you consider yourself an artisan author?
Crickets.
Could you say yes?
Well, I don't know. Because I was listening, I thought it was actually really funny when they're like, nobody thinks in terms of commercial. And I was like, oh God, like I kind of do because I like commercial fiction. I like reading it. I like writing it. But then I guess I don't know. Like, how do you define artisan?
I was kind of trying to get that. Like, I guess it's more the speed that you're not on the rapid release model, I suppose. So what is he was talking about things from the rapid release model that don't make sense in the real world. So if you're outside of that, I guess, do you agree or disagree? So quantity over quality. I'm like, yeah, I think I agree with that. Obviously, you want a good quality book, but there's always a balance, right? You also don't want to spend
Yeah.
7 years on a book. So.
I was gonna say, like, there's kind of an impression with like some writers want to be like an artist with a capital A. And, I guess what I mean is they're like very precious about their ideas and their words. And so I guess if you want to have a career, you do kind of have to let some of that go just because, like at a certain point, the reader has to be the king. Like, it can't necessarily be your vision anymore. It's like you're. It, I think I've heard a lot of people discuss like writing as like a relationship with your readers. So you can't really like be precious about it. So I don't know where that falls in on being. I guess you could be an artisan to a certain point, but then not. I don't
Yeah.
know.
I would define more towards the realm of artisan because, like, I do the direct sales and I do Kickstarter. And especially like this book that is taking 800 years to get from the printer. It's really focused on the artistry of bringing in, artists to do like 20 pieces of artwork to get sprayed edges to make the book look really pretty so that it is like a user experience that goes beyond just reading the story. And I think that there's like the artisan side of that. This question also makes me think a lot about that one book that I think I made you read, Christine, of like, you're going to need a bigger story. Because it's sort of the question of like the transmedia idea where your story can be one entry point, but you can continue to expand on that and sort of create this, quote unquote journey for your reader that includes, the side stories within that same world, the artists like are bringing in artwork for that, having different bits of media to really make that experience something more that is just the story. And I think that like the more that you do that per story would be more leaning towards the like gradient of artisan versus rapid or whatever the other term would be.
And I think we've talked about this a lot that there are different reader sets. There's the whale readers who just read compulsively, and then there are readers who read maybe 12 books or less a year who are maybe looking for a different type of book. So I thought it was interesting when he's saying, this stuff made sense in the beginning when KU first came around to juice the algorithm. Like if you price your bike books lower, more people would see them. But outside of that model, it makes no sense. So he's talking about really targeting individuals who aren't those readers that are reading the 99 cents in massive quantity. So I thought that was kind of interesting. I don't know.
There's a sea change shift going on. If you take a step back and look at it, like based on what you guys just said, like if you look at traditionally published books 10, 15 years ago, that was very artisan based on what's happening today. And then the indie world was doing the rapid release and all this other stuff. Yeah. In today's world, the trad authors are moving more towards rapid release, and they're basically doing a lot of the things the indie authors were doing earlier, and indie authors are now pivoting towards the other. So it's like they're doing this dance. I don't know that one is better than the other, but I do know a lot of traditional authors, you know, if you asked them 5 years ago, they weren't allowed to put out more than one book a year. Mm-hmm. And now the publishers are asking them to. And you know, they're doing series where they were doing standalone before, you know, like a lot of these things are tying together. You know, you look at BookBub and it's all trad authors now. There's hardly any indies on there. Yeah. So maybe this is just the next thing, which makes me think this is what trad authors are going to be doing 5 years. Like it's going to, you know, it's going to switch back again because they're always chasing.
Yeah. It's an interesting idea. And I don't know what the answer is, because obviously like writing is an art no matter how you do it. Right? Like if you're writing, it's art. So there's sort of an idea of defining, like, you know, what makes art. I just think even in general, like, I mean, in the art world, it's an interesting conversation, right? Because like, there's like a huge variety of like, you know, impressionism and like, you know, then you have like a Jackson Pollock, like, is that art? It's just like splatters, but they're expensive and people like them. So, you know, I don't know. Art is an interesting thing to think about.
It's intriguing, right? So it grabs your attention, whether it's, you know, this fine painting that, you know, everybody looks photorealistic versus a Jackson Pollock. But like each one, you know, if you walk past them, they grab your eye and you take a step closer and then take another look at it. And reading is really no different. You could be churning out mass market paperbacks, or you could be writing that literary novel. But if people are stopping, pausing to read whatever it is, then you're doing your job.
Yeah. I agree.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. All right. I guess with that, JD, who's up next week?
Next week, we've got Kelsea Yu coming on. She's a Shirley Jackson Award-winning author of several novels, has been published over a dozen short stories over her career. Her latest book is called Demon Song. It's a gothic horror inspired by Chinese mythology, which releases in September, September 30th, I believe.
Sounds great. If you'd like to be notified as soon as new episodes publish, make sure you go to writersincpodcast.com and sign up now. We'll see you next episode and have a great week of writing.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Writers Inc. Access the show notes and leave a comment at writersincpodcast.com.